From the studios of KUSP in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Angela Cartwright is my guest. In addition to being my first crush, Angela Cartwright played Linda on Make Room for Daddy and Penny in Lost in Space and is the star of one of the greatest films ever, The Sound of Music. In addition to her acting career, Angela Cartwright is an artist and an author. Her latest book, co-authored with Tom McLaren, is Styling the Stars, Lost Treasures from the 20th Century Fox Archive. Angela Cartwright, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Styling the Stars, Lost Treasures from the 20th Century Fox Archive. In addition to some very insightful commentary on the history of the American motion picture, it's a collection of photos taken for continuity purposes at 20th Century Fox. How were these pictures intended to be used?
Well, a lot of people aren't familiar with the term continuity photograph. What it actually means is every film that is made, and for television and also for movies, the wardrobe and the hair department take photographs. And in the 30s, 40s, through to the 70s, these were done with film cameras. So
yes, we remember those. Film. It's an antique thing that people used to.
That's right. That old way of taking pictures. Now it's done digitally, and Polaroids were used, and now it's all digital. But I came across these photographs that, doing some research for Sound of Music, the Sound of Music family scrapbook, I came across these old pictures that were for continuity purposes. The wardrobe department and the hair department, they'll take a quick shot behind the scenes of the actor or actress in the outfits, and there's usually a clapboard beside them with the scenes that these outfits are used in. And that's the way that they're able to know what wardrobe to put out, depending on the scenes that are being shot. And also, you know, they're not always, movies and TV aren't always shot in order. So they shoot the pictures so that they can match, you know, the curl in their hair or the way a tie is worn or whether a jacket's buttoned or unbuttoned. It's all about the precision of making it look like it's one continuous scene. So these have been shot from the very beginning just to help wardrobe and the hair department. And then those photographs would be developed, and then they'd be, you know, sent to the wardrobe and hair departments, and they would have them for reference. And then they would just end up in a big box and go to the archives and be, you know, there for never to really be seen. I mean, they weren't meant to be seen by anybody, but guess what? I've uncovered them.
And we get to see them. There's a cute one of you here in the beginning of the book, and I think this is from The Sound of Music, and you look very happy to have this picture taken. Do you remember posing for pictures like this?
Are you talking about the one where it's the party scene and the clapboard's on the chair?
Yes, and you have your little toe pointed out.
Yeah, you know, a lot of times people smiled. You know, a lot of times it was kind of a pain in the butt, and so they would be, you know, look a little annoyed. A lot of actors would be, you know, on their break, and the wardrobe would say, hey, I need this shot, and they would just get up. You know, they'd have a cigarette or coffee in their hand. They're very spontaneous, and you can kind of tell a lot of the actors' personalities. Like Paul Newman, he was such a goofball, and you could tell in his continuity pictures he was always pulling a face or doing something that was, you know, kind of funny. And he's not the only one. I mean, there are others also.
That's one of the interesting things about this book is that, you know, you think of 20th Century Fox people like Marilyn Monroe and Shirley Temple, but you've got so many stars that were not 20th Century Fox people that show up in this book, like Gable and Bogart and Betty Davis.
Well, they were only in the book if they had made a movie at 20th Fox. So they may not be known as a star from 20th, but they at least made one movie, like James Cagney, 13 Rue Madeleine.
Mm-hmm.
He only made one movie at 20th Fox. So there's nobody in this book that did not make a 20th Fox movie.
Yeah, so you found this treasure trove of these pictures. I just love them. I'm so glad that you are sharing them with me and everybody else. Barry Livingston was here. He was a kid who played on My Three Sons, and he was telling us about how when they shot the show, they shot it completely out of sequence because Fred McMurray only wanted to work a few weeks a year. And he said sometimes they would have to come back shoot something, and the kids had all grown a couple of inches. And I thought about that when you were talking about in The Sound of Music that was a problem. The kids lost their teeth or put on weight.
Absolutely. First of all, I know Stanley because I played his girlfriend in My Three Sons. Did you know that?
Yes, of course.
Yes. That was not unusual. And when you work with children, they grow, they lose teeth, they, they change. So that did happen during Sound of Music because it was such a long shoot. It took an entire year to shoot the entire movie with rehearsals, recording the songs and learning, all the choreography, and then going to Salzburg, where Mother Nature rained a lot more than they anticipated. So we were actually there for 3 months. It was when, movies took a long time to make, there was a lot of love and energy poured into that movie. But over a year, a kid, depending on how old they are, can change so much. So they would,
Did they give you injections?
No, nothing that drastic. But, movie is all about magic, and filming is all about, kind of what the audience is meant to see. And so there are certain things that can be done to make people look, taller, thinner, different than what they really are in real life, like standing in a hole because maybe the actress is taller than the actor is, little tricks that the audience never sees. Or, like on soap operas, they do it all the time where the actress is pregnant and just happens to stand behind a bouquet of flowers, I mean, that's what movies are about. It's about magic.
Did you ever have to stand in a hole because you were taller than your boyfriend?
No, not that I remember. We did have to stand on apple boxes sometimes, which are, they're boxes that used to hold apples, and they're just called apple boxes. And sometimes to make a close-up of a two-shot, so that the actors are closer together in height, say it was me and maybe Guy Williams or something,
yep.
And to make the shot closer, they would put me on an apple box so I'd be a little bit taller.
So when you worked in television, now your first, you mentioned Paul Newman, that was your first movie, wasn't it? Paul Newman's Somebody Up There Likes Me.
That's correct.
Do you
I played his daughter.
Do you remember being in that? Well, you were tiny.
Oh, I wish I remembered it better. I was only three. It was a traumatic, so it's not like I didn't remember it for some reason. But I was three. I don't remember it that well. But when I see it, it feels familiar.
Yeah. What about Make Room for Daddy? Do you remember? Because you were pretty young. That was kind of scared me, I have to tell you, because there was an older daughter. Then suddenly she went away, and she was never heard from again. And you were there.
Yeah, she wanted out of the show, so they sent her to college. But that's just another showbiz trick. I was four when I started the Danny Thomas Show, and it went for 7 years.
Right. How did you learn your lines when you were four?
Well, it's a lot easier to learn them when you're a kid. I used to know everybody's lines.
Really?
Because there's just not all the garbage in everybody's head, or the worry about memorizing. It just used to go in, and my mom used to read me my lines while I took my bath at night, and I would just know it.
Hmm. We're talking with Angela Cartwright, and you know who she is. She's the greatest, and she's got a new book, and it's called Styling the Stars, Lost Treasures from the 20th Century Fox Archive. Talk a little bit about Danny Thomas and Make Room for Daddy. I mean, that was done, was it done like in front of an audience? It looked like it was.
Yes, it was done in front of a live audience every Thursday night, and it was shot with three cameras, and we hardly, in 7 years I was on it, I can't even remember how many times we did a retake. It was just a one-take deal, and you just brought it, and you just did it. It was like doing a play. And, you know, Danny was extremely creative. He was very gregarious and funny. He just, you know, he taught me everything I know about comedy and timing. He was just, you know, he knew what worked. He was just a very bright guy. You know, he had a lot of shows that he produced on the Desilu lot, which was Lucille Ball's studio. That's where we shot Make Room for Daddy.
Right, the old RKO studios, right?
Yeah, well, and then there were a lot of spinoffs. You know, Andy Griffith spun off of our show, Joey Bishop.
Right.
There were just a lot of spin-off shows from that because comedy was just brand new. It was a baby, and people were enjoying it. They liked to come home and watch the show. And I've got to say, my parents are in their 90s, and
wow,
they look so forward to watching the Danny Thomas Show. It's on here on a TV show station that shows old-time shows. And it's like back to back, so it's an hour, and they literally plan their day around sitting and watching it. Of course, for them, it's probably another experience because my mom would remember going over the lines with me, and you know they always used to sit in the audience and watch the show live. But still, it's just a lot of fun, that whole genre. And then it kind of changed, and you know then they would shoot things more than once. There were still a few live shows, but
right,
then there was all that canned laughter period that went on, and
yeah,
I just never understood that. It always sounded so mechanical. It's like, okay, laugh now.
Right. Whereas the Danny Thomas Show was actually funny. That's why people laughed.
Well, it was real. That's what happened.
You and Rusty Hamer were like the first of a long line of wisecracking kids. They sort of set a sort of a style, and you were both extremely good at it.
You know, it's curious because I would never have gotten away with any of that at my house. We're all born in England, and you know, the wisecracking and the you know, all those kind of things that we used to do during that show and the remarks we used to make. It was fun. I enjoyed doing that. It was, you know, playing a part. Linda was spunky.
Yeah, and so cute. Adorable. And then Lost in Space, which is a favorite of mine and everybody in my generation. That show was filmed like a movie, right?
That was, yes. That was shot on a sound stage, out of order. You know, we would shoot all the scenes that would take place inside the spaceship, you know, and then we would go into another location, then you'd shoot all of those all at one time, so it wasn't the same experience as being in front of a live audience. But yeah, that was the way that they were doing those productions. And then when there were like special effects, you know, your pulse would like, you know, rise a little bit because you knew you didn't want to be the one to screw up when those you know,
when
explosions went off. And during the pilot, we were running into a cave. I don't know if you remember this, because they took the pilot and they divided it up into five different episodes, I think it was. But Guy Williams actually has his laser gun turned on, and he shoots all of us while we're running in, and there's all these rocks falling, and, you know, it was like an earthquake. Yeah, that was something I was glad I didn't do. Then they had to reset it, you know, and that would take all the time to reset all the rocks and all of that. So,
what's it like having your whole life that you can look at in your entire, pretty much every point in your life, you can see yourself on film?
What's it like?
Yeah. I mean, I guess you have nothing to compare it to because you've always been Angela Cartwright.
I don't really have anything to compare it to, but I've got to say, I've had a really good life. I mean, I was very blessed to have had these experiences and been able to, you know, travel and work with great people, and I love creativity, so it's been very fulfilling on that account.
Did you go to school when you were on the set, or how did that work?
Well, when you're in show business and you do, you're a child and you have to go to school and you have to go for 3 hours every day. So if you're the only kid in a show, you're there by yourself, and if there's other kids, then you're in a schoolhouse with them or on the set in a trailer. So it's very disciplined as far as getting your work done. I went to, you know, studio school for almost my entire education. So when I did go back to regular school for, I think I went for a couple summers, you know, when school was starting up and we were on hiatus. To me, that was summer because it was hiatus.
Right.
I was just right up with everybody else. I mean, I knew what they knew, and, you know, I had my assignments, and if I had a hard time getting something, I used to be able to have a teacher. You know, it was like private tutoring. So it's kind of like homeschooling now, I guess. So it did work. You know, it was hard to go to high school in my senior year. The second half of my senior year, I did go to high school, and that was tough.
Was that because Lost in Space was over or whatever?
Yeah, Lost in Space was over. I stayed on the lot for a while. They had me go to school there. And then they let me go, and that was really hard to walk into a group of kids that had been together all of their high school years, and here I was, and they recognized me, you know, from the show. It was hard. It was tough.
Did they, you know, did they accept you, or did they say, oh, you know, she's the movie star?
You know what? A couple of the kids accepted me. One just accepted me because she wanted money. And the other one I am still friends with.
Oh, well, that's good.
After all these years, which is really, that was nice, you know, but it was tough because you never knew who was sincere about being your friend. And, you know, kids made fun of you. It was the same that kids go through today. You just have to get a thick skin.
Well, you know, there's a lot about child stars and the difficulty of being one and what happens to you when you're not a kid anymore. Or, you know, I mean, Shirley Temple, for instance, had kind of a difficult time of it and eventually just kind of gave up, I guess. And there's a wonderful moment in your book. I just thought it was just so touching and beautiful that Maureen O'Hara contributed to the book, talking about working with Natalie Wood in Miracle on 34th Street.
Yeah, wasn't that lovely?
Oh, really, really sweet.
I know, you know, I love Maureen O'Hara, and I was so thrilled that she agreed to write a foreword for us. You know, Natalie was, you know, in the business, started very young. So she, you know, when you start that young, the crew becomes like another family to you. In my case, I did not come from a broken home. My parents are still together. I mentioned they're still alive.
Yeah.
We have that good old sturdy European stock, I guess. You know, it just becomes a different life for you. That's the way it is. And kids are often, you know, always around adults, so they don't get a lot of child, you know, playtime mm-hmm. with regular kids. I was lucky. I lived on a neighborhood. I had a really, really good friend that lived two doors away from me. We're still friends today, too. And I think I credit a lot to her because, you know, she would play Barbies with me. We played school. It was fun, and I was able to be a kid. A lot of that I credit my parents with letting me be able to just be, ride bikes, you know, and all that stuff that kids do.
How did you get along with the kids that you acted with? Because you had two shows in which you were, or actually three shows, I guess, if you include Make Room for Granddaddy, that you were part of a family of other kids.
Oh, well, Rusty was a bit annoying at times.
Yeah.
He used to trip me and pull my hair and stuff. I have a feeling that had to do with the age difference.
Yeah.
And, you know, he had been on the show before me because Danny Thomas show ran for 11 years.
Right, he was the little boy, and then he became the older
right.
boy. Yeah.
And he became older, and he was a bit of a brat at times. But, you know, I survived. Sound of Music was a blast to do because I had other kids to play with.
Yeah.
That was really fun.
Now, you're like in the middle, right, in that one?
I was me. Yeah. Don't worry, me. That was my note. Yes, I was Brigitte.
Did you do your own singing in the picture?
I did. We all did. Uh-huh. We all did our own singing.
Even Julie Andrews? They didn't dub her? No, of course. She
certainly did do her own singing with her beautiful voice. Yeah, so that was kind of fun to have other kids to do that big movie with, you know?
Yeah. Did did you stay friends with them, or are you in touch with them?
Yeah, it's, you know, from Lost in Space, I'm still friends with Marta and good friends with Bill.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Sound of Music, we're all still friendly. We're kind of like this family that, you know, all lives in all over the world. I mean, Nikki lives in Australia and, you know, Minnesota and all over. And then we, like, come back together and we pick up where we left off. So we're kind of like this little dysfunctional family that kind of gets together, you know, a couple times a year. Although next year, who knows, it'll be the 50th That's anniversary right. for The Sound of Music.
Yeah. Wow.
So
Now, when you were making The Sound of Music, first of all, how did you get the part? Did you have to read for the part or what?
I did have to read for the part. And Robert Wise had a very clear vision of, he didn't want everybody to look like they were coming out of a gingerbread house. He wanted real kids that looked like a real family, that each had their own personality, which is what happens when people watch the movie. They relate to one of the kids in some way. I just think he was a brilliant director. He was always very patient, and, you know, he cast it very smart. I knew I was going to be out of work when I was doing the Danny Thomas show. Danny had decided to hang it up after 11 years for him, and he let me out of the last Danny Thomas show so that I could start The Sound of Music. And I'm forever grateful for that, because he didn't have to do that. That was very, very kind of him to do. And he wrote me out of the last show so that I could do that movie.
Wow.
And I was just really grateful, because in showbiz, you don't have to do that.
And they didn't they didn't wrap up series with final episodes like they do now.
No, they didn't. They kind of just left it out in the open. You know, he's still there entertaining.
Because the show was in syndication. He was in syndication even then. I used to see it in the afternoon.
Well, they have a lot of shows. Those were the days when they did, like, 26
Right,
shows.
Right. Yeah, not like now.
I mean, they did a lot of episodes.
I bet they did even more than that. I bet they had, like, 30 or something, 33 or something like that.
Yeah, maybe it was more, actually. I think Lost in Space was more like 26 episodes or something a year.
Yeah.
They don't do that anymore. You're lucky if you get 5 episodes.
I know.
They don't even give a show a chance.
No, they cancel it right away. In those days, even a terrible show would stay on the air for at least a season, sometimes more.
Exactly, and gave you a chance to not watch it.
That's right.
But now there's this so much competition, you know, with all the cable networks and all of that stuff.
Yeah, it was a different, definitely a different time. So the first thing that happened in The Sound of Music was going to Europe, or did they shoot things in at the studio first, or what?
Well, we rehearsed for many months, which I think was very, very wise of Robert Wise. Hey, there's an interesting pun. Because we knew those numbers inside and out. We knew the dance steps perfectly. And it was second nature. I mean, we can still do them to this day. We always laugh about that. I mean, when we get together, we usually line up in our line. We knew it so well. And that was very smart time spent. Because when we got to Austria and we got on the locations, it was never because one of us made a mistake that, you know, they had to keep doing it because we didn't know the words or we were out of sync. We had practiced so much that we were totally ready to perform, and so it wasn't because of us they had to do other takes.
Yeah, well, that's good. Did you know that it was going to be a great movie?
No. No, none of us did. We knew that something was happening. I can remember there was a wonderful energy about it. We adored Julie. She brought so much love to all of us. we loved being around her. And you can see it in the scenes, like My Favorite Things. Even, you know, little Kimmy, who was 5, and Debbie, who was 7, you know, they adored her. And between takes, she would sing to us and entertain us. And so you could tell throughout the movie how crazy we are about her. You know, and Chris, as a choice, I think, kind of stayed, you know, at an arm's distance. And that's the way the kids reacted to him. You know, really and truly, only Nikki and Kimmy, who had been in a few movies, and myself were professional actors. The others were not. They had done maybe a few commercials or whatever.
That scene where she comes, where Julie Andrews comes back and joins you in My Favorite Thing, that's one of the greatest scenes. It never fails to make me cry, even though I know that it's going to come. I start tearing up even now as I'm thinking about it.
Isn't it interesting how there's certain things that just, I don't know, it's just so heartwarming. And it just brings out emotion in a lot of people. And I think guys and ladies alike, you know, just relate to parts in this movie. Either it's something they wanted, something they had, something they're trying to capture. It's just so uplifting. It's just a great movie all around and so beautiful.
I love it. You know, one of the subtexts, I guess, or points that you make, Angela Cartwright, in your new book, Styling the Stars, Lost Treasures from the 20th Century Fox Archive, is kind of about the end of the studios and the decline of the studio system. And, you know, you were kind of right there when it happened. Did you realize then that things were changing so rapidly?
Well, I was young. You know, they did used to have actors under contract, and they would mold them into the kind of actor or actress they wanted the public to see. They had a lot of control over their contract players. I was never a contract player, but they did keep me on the lot because I think they wanted to use me in something else, but nothing really came up at the time. I remember I auditioned for The Prime of Miss Jean Brody, mm-hmm. but there was like a nude scene in it, and I wasn't 18, so I couldn't do it. not that I would have anyway, but...
I'm so sorry that you didn't. Oh, sorry. I didn't say that out loud, did I?
Well, I think most of the studios had control over the people in their lives that were in the movies. But that began to kind of disintegrate, and actors, there were some actors that, you know, worked for other films, and then they got lent out to 20th to maybe fulfill their contract. You know, Marilyn Monroe, you know, she had like a 7-movie deal or something. They had to come up with the stuff to fulfill their part of it, or just pay them off. It's just so complicated and big business. But I was around during that time. It was a very exciting time, and I write about that in this book. I can remember that so well because it was a microcosm of life for me. It was being in the studios at the most exciting time I think that there was, when every stage was bustling with something because they were able to do that then, you know. They were able to make more movies for less amount of money.
Yeah, it was interesting when you talked about how around the time of Butch Cassidy that they were making budget cuts, and instead of making costumes, they got costumes from Western Costume or whatever. And that was like, you know, I never thought about that the factories that made the movies, you know, they manufactured all these beautiful costumes.
Well, one other amazing thing is that Audrey Hepburn, when she made 2 for the Road, she had 4 designers make her clothes. 4 designers.
I have that.
Well known. I mean, they, you know, they were well known designers, Poco Rabanne and Mary Quant. I mean, these were people that were brought on to wardrobe her. And so there were 5 people that worked on that, her wardrobe supervisor, and then 4 major designers. They don't do that anymore, yeah. Unless you have like 1 designer it designs all your costumes. And of course, one of the things that I really wanted to get across in this book is it's not about just the actor or the actress that makes a great movie. There are all these other people that have to do their job well to make the actor and actress really look as good as they possibly can. You know, there's people that light you, and there's sound, and then there's, you know, the wardrobe people and the hair people, and they're all really going after one thing, and that is to do the best that they can do to make this character believable. You know, that's kind of, it's a very cool thing. It's like, you know, having a group of people all working towards one end. If it's a movie that melds together, of course there are certainly those that don't.
Well, it's interesting. You talk about some of the not so great movies like Valley of the Dolls, and you know, but yet Valley of the Dolls has a wealth of wonderful pictures of people in their costumes. That picture of Judy Garland wearing the kind of a mini skirt.
Yeah,
it's really
how
amazing.
Trippy is that? yeah, Judy was cast in that movie, and then she wasn't.
Yeah.
Those outfits were all designed by Travilla, the designer Travilla, who did a lot of things for 20th.
Well, I love this book. It's a beautiful book, and thank you for sharing these pictures with us, and thank you so much for talking about your career and your life here on From the Bookshelf. Angela Cartwright, it's been just a thrill to talk to you.
Nice talking to you.
That's it for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. I hope you had a good time and that you'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to the podcast at iTunes, and you can like us on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, Angela Cartwright. Can you believe Angela Cartwright was on the show? Her new book is called Styling the Stars, Lost Treasures from the 20th Century Fox Archive. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.